Hello there. Today is Tuesday, October 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, U.S. allies express concern over President Trump's plans to back out of the Iran nuclear agreement.
They're great negotiators. They negotiated a phenomenal deal for themselves, but a horrible deal for the United States.
The death toll continues to rise from a violent terror attack in Somalia. Health care for low-income Americans in question following Trump's decision not to pay subsidies. And 16 fires in California still burning.
Then the winds came up. The fire was like a fire tsunami. It was like a fireball. The winds were so fierce.
It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump's refusal to certify the Iran nuclear deal has sparked a new war of words between the Islamic Republic and America, fueling growing mistrust and a sense of nationalism among Iranians.
The Iran deal that right now is being studied, and I think a lot of people agreed with what I did. I feel strongly about what I did. I'm tired of being taken advantage of as a nation. This nation has been taken advantage of for many, many years, for many decades, frankly, and I'm tired of watching it. But the Iran deal was something that I felt had to be done, and we'll see what phase two is. Phase two might be positive, and it might be very negative. It might be a total termination. That's a very real possibility. Some would say that's a greater possibility. But it also could turn out to be very positive. We'll see what happens. I thought the tone of the Iranian leaders was very modified, and I was happy to see that, but I don't know if that means anything. They're great negotiators. They negotiated a phenomenal deal for themselves, but a horrible deal for the United States.
EU foreign ministers meeting in Luxembourg on Monday echoed concerns from international leaders over Trump's decision to decertify that Iran was in compliance of the accord. The European Union is sending its top diplomat, Federica Mogherini, to Washington to fight for the Iran nuclear deal.
The European Union considers President Trump's decision not to certify Iran's compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as being in the context of an internal U.S. process. The European Union encourages the United States to maintain its commitment to the JCPOA and to consider the implications for the security of the United States, its partners, and the region before taking further steps.
None of the five nations or the EU that reached the deal with Iran has agreed with Trump's stance against it. Joining me now to discuss is Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian Council and author of the book Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. So what went into this deal? How long did it take? How difficult was it? Tell us about it.
Well, this is one of the most successful negotiations of the past couple of years, perhaps decades. The negotiations themselves on the Iran issue, when the Europeans initiated it, started actually about 12 years before the deal actually was struck. But the period in which the United States got really seriously involved is approximately 2 years long. And it started off with secret negotiations in Oman, in which the U.S. and Iran met directly and far away from the eyes of the camera could actually have a much more direct and honest conversation instead of just issuing speeches to each other. And the breakthrough that occurred in March 2013 paved the way for a much more effective negotiation at the P5+1 level. And roughly 6 months later, an interim deal was reached. And it took roughly a year and a half more of negotiations. And just to give you an idea of how intense this was, for the last round of negotiations, they went several days above the deadline. John Kerry was in Vienna, the Austrian capital, for 17 days straight negotiating. Many members of its team had been there for more than 27 days straight negotiating. For the Secretary of State of the United States, that has the entire globe as his responsibility, to devote 17 straight to this issue is quite unprecedented. And it tells you how intense it was, but also the tremendous effort that was put into reaching this.
Interesting, because no one is really disputing that Iran is in compliance with the deals. It would appear that his Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense are both saying that we should probably stay in this deal. What is your view on that?
Well, I think what it tells you is that the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, recognize that the path Trump is going down on and trying to kill the deal is going to be tremendously costly for the United States. I don't think the Secretary of State nor the Secretary of Defense are fans of this deal for reasons that go outside of the nuclear field. But they recognize that leaving it or killing it will be tremendously problematic for the United States. Unfortunately, the president is not listening to them. Instead, he is going down a path that will see this deal killed unless someone stops Trump.
What do you see as some of the things that will be problematic about leaving this deal?
On the first level, we have to keep in mind what this deal did is that it took two horrific scenarios off the table. The scenario of Iran getting a nuclear weapon and the scenario of the United States going to war with Iran. If you kill the deal, these two scenarios come back onto the table. And we may very soon once again see that the drums of war will be beating very, very intensely. Because if the Iranians restart their program without the restrictions that currently exist, without the transparency and the inspections that currently exist, rest assured, the same voices that pushed for war up until 2013 will be pushing, but even harder this time around. But beyond that, look how this is splitting the United States from its allies. The day after Trump did this speech against the deal, initiated the process of getting out of the deal, French President Macron announced that he is visiting Tehran, which will be the first visit by a French president to Tehran since 1976. So any effort to isolate Iran is clearly not working out. The Europeans remain very committed to this deal. They believe that it is truly a triumph of diplomacy, and they're absolutely abhorred that not only is President Trump undermining the Paris Agreement, he left UNESCO, he's fiddling with NATO, and now he's also doing this. They're seeing a pattern in which the President of the United States is essentially targeting almost all international agreements and institutions that constitute the very bedrock of the current international system.
That's a lot of damage when you talk about your allies. How can you actually, if you're in a multilateral agreement with other allies and one pulls out, how would that work?
There is a small chance that the deal could survive even without the United States. If the Europeans stand firm and continue to give the Iranians the economic benefits of them continuing to comply with the deal, that would also mean that there would be an even greater rift between the United States and its allies. But the idea that the United States can change the terms of the deal by going to Congress is simply preposterous. This is a deal between seven countries. It took years to negotiate, and the United States Congress is not above those governments. It cannot come and unilaterally change the terms of the deal. Imagine how laughable it would be if the Iranian parliament came out and thought that they can just simply unilaterally change the terms of the deal and say they're not going to give up this amount of centrifuges, they're not going to give up this amount of low-enriched uranium, and expect that everyone else in the P5++1 would just simply cave and accept that. That's preposterous, and it shows you the immaturity that the Trump administration is approaching international issues.
How concerned are you?
I am as concerned as I was in 2012, 2013, where it was very clear that this was moving towards a war. But this time around, in some ways, it's really much worse, because it's not just about the international, it's not just about the Iran deal. I think it's about the United States' role in the international community as a whole. Does the United States want to lead, be an inspiration, or does it want to be a bully and twist the arm of its friends and enemies alike and to do everything the America first way?
That's Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian Council and author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. We thank you very much for being with us. Well, the death toll keeps climbing after Saturday's massive truck bombing in Mogadishu. By Monday afternoon, the Somali government put the death count at close to 300 and 429 at least wounded. And now analysts say the Somali government must be more vigilant against improvised explosive devices in the country if it's to avoid similar attacks in the future. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
It's being called the single deadliest attack in Somalia's history. A huge truck bomb that detonated in the middle of a busy Mogadishu intersection on Saturday. Its magnitude stunned a city already well accustomed to deadly bombings by the al-Qaeda-linked terror group al-Shabaab, although no one has yet claimed responsibility. Rashid Abdi, Horn of Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group, says the horrendous loss of life eclipses anything seen in Somalia in the last two decades.
For the next decade, Al-Shabaab will continue to be a threat, and I think they will continue to launch these kind of suicide attacks.
Abdi says that the internal security apparatus in the country needs to be strengthened, but notes that the task cannot be completed in a day. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. President Trump calls for quick end to the election-related Russia probes. Kirkuk shuttered as Iraqi forces advance on Kurdish Peshmerga. The Korean DMZ visit is under consideration for a Trump visit to Asia. And hashtag MeToo. Thousands are sharing stories of sexual abuse. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. Hey, Andrew, what's happening?
Lori, I will give you one guess as to the perpetually trending story that we always talk about that is again trending today.
It has to do with Russia, social media, Facebook, Google.
Ding, ding, ding. Russia and the interference on social media. It is a perpetual trending topic because there is more and more news that comes out about this.
Yeah.
And today we're getting news about Twitter and some issues that they're having and Facebook and some hiring that they're doing. So we start with Twitter because, of course, Facebook wasn't the only social network that Russia used, even though it was apparently the most prominent. Twitter was used with fake advertising, fake accounts to try to influence opinions. But as investigators look into this meddling on Twitter, there's one issue, Lori.
Mm-hmm.
The information has been deleted. Now, the surprising thing about this is who deleted it? Twitter. Apparently, Twitter's policy, which is actually supported and praised by a lot of digital information and privacy advocates, is that once you delete your Twitter account, all your tweets, all your messages, everything are actually deleted, as opposed to other social networks like Facebook, where after you deactivate or delete your account, your information sticks around for quite a while on their servers.
Interesting.
So this policy to protect users on Twitter actually is now causing headaches for government investigators because a lot of these tweets have been deleted. Now, it's not just Twitter. Some of the account holders deleted the information, so it wasn't necessarily that Twitter removed it. It's more because of their policy. But they're going to probably have to make some changes as a result of this. They've said that once an account has been deactivated, there's a very brief period in which we may be able to access account information, including tweets. But in this case, they can't do that. So expect to see a change with how your information is being dealt with on Twitter. I have a feeling that this policy is going to be shifted and information is going to stick around for much longer now.
Wow.
After this.
Okay. Anything else going on?
Yes. So Facebook is the other big social network that has had Russian interference, as we just mentioned.
Yeah.
And because of the investigation into that, Facebook is bulking up their workforce in one key area. According to Bloomberg News, Facebook is making a big push to hire people with security clearances. So these are people with government clearance to view classified information or top secret documents. So now this could make it easier for Facebook to exchange information with investigators. It could make it easier for Facebook to look into suspicious activity. Instead of having government investigators come in, they can use their own people right at Facebook.
Hmm.
But this is another big shift. Usually Facebook is looking for innovators, for tech-savvy people, for coders. Now they're looking for people who may have been employed as formerly government employees or government contractors or security specialists or people in the military, all fields where you have to have a government security clearance. So it's all part of how this investigation is changing how these social media companies work and how we use social media.
All right, Andrew, thank you. And you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, in a brash move likely to roil insurance markets, President Donald Trump stopped payments to insurers under the Obama-era health care law that he has been trying to unravel for months. The White House said in a statement that the government cannot legally continue to pay the so-called cost-sharing subsidies because they lack a formal authorization by Congress. Meanwhile, 18 U.S. states are vowing to sue the Trump administration to try to stop him from scrapping that key component of Obamacare, the subsidies to insurers that help millions of low-income people pay medical expenses. Joining me now for some understanding of what's happening here is healthcare expert and attorney Rob Fuller, co-author of the book From Obamacare to Trump Care and Why You Should Care. So what exactly happens now with the president's latest move?
The elimination of the CSRs is probably the most immediate impact that he has.
CSR is what?
Is the cost-sharing reduction subsidies.
Mm-hmm.
They're like the super discounts that are given to low-income working people who cannot afford their insurance, even with the tax credits that are given. And they get an additional discount to cover their financial obligations. These have been taken away by the administration and will cause, according to the CBO, 1 million people to lose their insurance in coming months.
Wow. Okay. So the president says this is going to help people bring their costs down and ultimately be a good thing.
That would be what he's directed the cabinet departments to look at, which are the skinny benefit plans that people are talking about. Unfortunately, as healthy people migrate to the skinny benefit plans, the rest of the population who maybe aren't so healthy and need regular insurance are going to find very large premium increases in their traditional insurance if they can't migrate to a skinny benefit plan.
How detrimental could this be for Americans that would not otherwise be able to afford health insurance?
It's going to be extremely detrimental. Taking away the CSRs impacts the low-income working population right now. They won't be able to afford any insurance that's out there currently. The skinny benefit plans might come next year or possibly the year after. They're not really out in the market yet. But even so, signing up for one may not mean you have much health insurance at all. If they only provide for, let's say, $100 a day hospital coverage, you could have a very large hospital bill very quickly, even if you're healthy, if you get in a car accident or have some unexpected disease state jump up on you.
Ultimately, is this the beginning of the end of the Affordable Care Act?
Possibly. What we think is that Mr. Trump is trying to destabilize markets and cause anxiety to the point where Congress has to act and give him something in the way of a legislative package. We don't think he's too particular about what may be in the package, but he's trying to force people to do a deal by destabilizing health insurance in this country. That would seem to be the logical explanation for the many steps taken by the administration in the past few weeks.
Where do you see all this going?
Well, they've truncated the open enrollment period. They've eliminated navigators. They've cut out birth control coverage. They're cutting out the CSRs. They're trying to introduce skinny benefit plans for healthy people, I guess. It seems to me he's trying to force some kind of moment when insurers say they just have to raise rates by 25-35% or get out of markets, and that will cause enough anxiety and noise in the market that Congress will finally have to act and either redo the ACA or come up with some more comprehensive solution. There are comprehensive solutions Republicans have talked about in the past. Mostly we've looked at the tax initiatives that were brought forward this year, but they're going to need to at some point address the substance of insurance, what it's going to be, how much it's going to cost, who's going to pay, and they're probably going to need Democratic support for a comprehensive bill. The problem we have is that there was no legislation that was brought forward that has frustrated the president, which is, you know, understandable. And since he's a businessman, not a politician, he's decided to do what he would do in business, which is to make the other side uncomfortable until they come back to the table.
He and the Republicans have repeatedly said that, you know, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare was a disaster, that it was unsustainable, that it was collapsing on its own. And yet I spoke to many health experts that said, no, that's just not true.
No, it's not true. It has actually helped healthcare providers provide better healthcare. It's been a little more expensive than they wanted, but not terribly so. And if all this does start cratering, the number one loser is actually going to be hospitals. We're going to go back to the 2000-aughts when the hospital ERs were the primary care doctors of America. And we see a return to that if something isn't done to correct the situation that seems to be emerging.
So if the situation stays the way it is, with Congress not doing anything to change anything, and with the president seemingly dismantling Obamacare, will we ultimately be going backwards as far as the number of people that are covered by health insurance and the whole issue of pre-existing conditions and things like that?
Right, because the insurance that will be offered, these skinny benefit plans, won't cover much. They won't cover pre-existing conditions. They'll be individually rated, which means if you're sick, they can kick you off. And you will have a lot of people just going without insurance. People know that hospitals have to see patients under EMTALA, and that's going to, once again, become a very big problem in this country.
That's healthcare attorney Rob Fuller with the Los Angeles-based Nelson Hardiman. Thanks for your time. You're listening to International Edition on VOA. We'll be right back.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. A spokesman for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection says that some fires are now 50 and 60% contained, but firefighters across the state are still battling at least 16 fires. The death toll rose to at least 40 on Saturday, but Fire Captain Jimmy Bernal says it is still a heartbreaking situation.
The biggest thing is we have lost way too many people on this fire. The intensity of the fire was incredible, so they're lost, and there's some multiple uncounted for, so the potential of more fatalities is huge, which is very, very sad.
Well, evacuees from a number of counties in California have been allowed to return home, as firefighters say they've turned a corner in containing the blazes that have devastated the state, but for many, they've got no home to go back to.
I have, you know, every one of my friends that live anywhere close by here, that we've lived here 29 years, they are homeless, and none of them can find places to live. None of them can find places to live. And one of our friends down the street, I mean, he's 98 years old. Him and his wife, 92 years old, lived there for 60 years, and they're homeless.
Some 70 or 5,700 homes and businesses have been destroyed. The strong, dry Santa Ana winds that blow down the mountains every late summer and early fall are creating conditions that make the fires spread very easily. Well, the nation's official recognition of American veterans annually on November 11th, Veterans Day, got an early start this year with a star-studded concert kicking off, a new fundraising movement for organizations that help the men and women who serve in uniform. VOA's David Byrd tells us about Vets Aid.
Joe Walsh is best known as a guitarist, both with the James Gang and later with the Eagles. But he is also the son of a military flight instructor who died while on active duty in Japan. Walsh says that because of his family history and his previous work with wounded veterans, he decided to start Vets Aid along the lines of the Farm Aid concerts started by country singer Willie Nelson.
We're at war. This is an ongoing war with no end in sight. And the transition back to civilian life is almost too big of a mountain to climb. Four times as many people are injured than actually killed. And I just decided that I can do something about it to help.
Walsh recruited what he called his guitar army, including blues phenom Gary Clark Jr., Keith Urban, and the Zac Brown Band.
Something wrong been going on.
Clark started the nearly four-hour concert with some of his hits, including Next Door Neighbor Blues and a cover of Come Together by the Beatles. Keith Urban had the crowd on its feet with his set, including Sweet Thing, Blue Ain't Your Color, and Wasted Time. The Zac Brown Band covered two guitar anthems in their set, Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, and The Devil Went Down to Georgia by the Charlie Daniels Band. Then Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, herself a combat-wounded veteran from Iraq, came on stage to urge the nearly 7,500 fans to support Vets Aid and to help Joe Walsh help veterans.
So tonight, I'm so grateful for my friend Joe Walsh, and I'm proud to introduce him. I'd also like you to join me in dedicating tonight's performance to the memory of his father, Lieutenant Robert Newton Fiddler.
The 69-year-old Walsh played several of his hits, including Funk No. 49, Life's Been Good, Rocky Mountain Way, and In the City. Joe Walsh says he hopes the concert is the first of many to help smaller organizations that work directly with veterans.
Our guys are coming home shattered. It's like a forgotten war over here. You don't see it on the news or anything. But we are at war. Raising the public awareness so that we all start to help vets is my goal.
All the proceeds from the concert go to help veterans organizations. Walsh says he thinks the effort is off to a good start, and he's hopeful that it will grow.
Thanks to all you vets.
In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States will continue its long tradition of welcoming and caring for refugees. During fiscal year 2018, the U.S. government has proposed admitting up to 45,000 refugees from Africa, 19,000, East Asia, 5,000, Europe and Central Asia, 2,000, Latin America and Caribbean, 1,500, Near East and South Asia, 17,500. The new limit of 45,000 refugees is lower than in recent years. It takes into account a number of factors: the security of the American people, the government's capacity to properly vet the refugees according to its enhanced security procedures, and the backlog of hundreds of thousands of asylum cases the Department of Homeland Security currently faces from people who have already come into the United States and are seeking protection. Since 1975, the U.S. has welcomed more than 3 million refugees. With the new ceiling limit, the United States will continue to permanently resettle more refugees than any other country and will keep offering protection to the most vulnerable of those who have been persecuted because of race, ethnicity, political opinion, nationality, religion, or membership in a particular social group. It is also important to note that refugee resettlement is only one part of the U.S.'s response to the global crisis of forced displacement. The U.S. remains the world's leading donor of humanitarian assistance, providing over $7 billion last year. During the 2017 fiscal year, the U.S. provided more than $1.4 billion in humanitarian assistance for the Syria crisis and more than $581 million for Iraq. In addition, the U.S. has given nearly $2.5 billion for people from countries facing famine and nearly $104 million for displaced persons in Burma and the region. We are also the number one contributor to the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and continue to be the leading donor to other agencies to provide life-saving support for refugees and conflict victims, including the Red Cross, Movement, the World Food Program, UNICEF, and a wide range of non-governmental humanitarian organizations. This support provides vital assistance to refugees and conflict victims close to their home countries, with the view to enabling refugees to return to their homes voluntarily and in safety when conditions permit. The United States takes pride in its humanitarian efforts and goals and will continue to care for people around the world who are fleeing violence and persecution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.